This is the May 13 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day are Dave Chatterton of Strategic Farm Marketing from Champaign, Illinois, Jackie Vakes of Total Farm Marketing out of Hollister, Missouri, and John Zanker of Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana. Our special guest today is Patrick DeHaan. He's the head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy. That's gasbuddy.com. He is in Chicago, Illinois. Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of our program anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org. Patrick DeHaan, thank you for being with us. This is the second time you've joined our show. This time around, I'd like to start with a question that the national news media has been following intently for the better part of a week now, because there was a lockdown of a pipeline that services the southeastern part of the United States into New York. Can you tell me a little bit about Colonial Penn, how big a service area it has, and what kind of problems it created when it was scammed, essentially?
Well, you know, this was a pretty big story across, I think, probably all sectors. You know, from the various topics that a cyber attack this big on this big of a piece of infrastructure, it was all the talk. Essentially, the Colonial Pipeline serves much of the south and eastern United States with refined products, diesel, jet fuel, gasoline. It picks up that product from Houston refineries, runs through Louisiana, does the same before it starts making deliveries in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, which has a spur down to southern Georgia. And then it makes its way up the eastern seaboard through the Carolinas, through Virginia, West Virginia, before jetting through D.C. and heading up to Linden, New Jersey. And that pipeline was completely shut as a result of a hack last Friday, a ransomware attack in which hackers were able to infiltrate through potentially an attachment in an email that was opened, then encrypted a computer. When Colonial learned of that, they shut down all of their IT to try and probably grasp what was going on, how many computers it affected. And by doing so, they knocked that pipeline off that delivers 100 million gallons of refined product per day. And very quickly, that was problematic, obviously. This is the primary mechanism for refined products supplied in those states I've mentioned. And as a result of that pipeline being down since last Friday, only getting back up yesterday, we have seen a tremendous amount of challenges in terms of supply, primarily gasoline supply, but also diesel, and some airlines even adjusting their schedules as Atlanta and Charlotte's airports both saw impact on jet fuel deliveries.
Dave Chatterton, you have a question for Patrick DeHaan?
Yeah, hey, Patrick, it's good to hear from you, and thanks for being on. I guess, you know, I'm by no means a structural or a chemical engineer here, but I guess my understanding of the pipeline system would indicate that there is still product in the pipe at this point. In other words, they have to maintain some amount of pressure to maintain the integrity of the pipeline. And we've heard these stories about product in the line only moving at, you know, 4 to 5 or 5 to 7 miles per hour in a 15-day trip from the Houston Gulf to the New York Harbor, et cetera. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of how you think the restart starts back up and where the gaps in supply? Is this just a situation of actually no supply, or a situation of, hey, I've got supply in the pipeline, but it's 8 days out or it's 10 days out type of a situation?
Well, like you mentioned, to maintain the flow, obviously the more product in the pipeline, the more pressure, the more flow, the faster products get to market. Now, earlier in the week, Colonial had said that they restarted Line 4, which is essentially a pickup in Greensboro, North Carolina, that goes northeast of about, I think it was 2 million barrels of product. Having said that, on the flip side, on restart, they had apparently gotten 2 million barrels of product to put in the pipeline in Houston from refineries that started seeing backups. So I'm sure refineries were eager to send that material in the pipeline. So I'm sure the flow is pretty consistent. As a result of that shutdown, as you mentioned, you know, I think the general public thinks that the pipeline, you know, was empty or that it has to start from scratch. But product is flowing very quickly as a result of the restart, since it's still generally filled with product, the deliveries can again resume very quickly, especially since Colonial has product to put right in the pipeline immediately. So things should start, the wheels should start to move. The interesting thing, I think, that wasn't really mentioned in the media so much about these outages is I think it turned into a lot of a panic-induced outage. That is, Southern Florida, for example, which is not supplied by the Colonial Pipeline, instead served by barge from the Gulf Coast, Miami was seeing a tremendous amount of outages today. This morning, starting at 5% of stations being out of gasoline, and last time I checked, it was up to 40%. So we were seeing very similar reactions throughout the entire area. I looked at Charlotte's rack this morning, and only a couple of suppliers out of potentially one and a half or two dozen were out of fuel. So I think the real story here was not necessarily the pipeline shutdown, but the reaction to it.
Jackie Vakes, do you have a question?
I'd like to just shift gears a little bit and move over to ethanol. You know, we know that ethanol demand dropped a great deal during the pandemic. Patrick, what do you see in terms of the potential rebound now as we're starting to come out of this?
Well, it's been a very strong rebound the last few months. Vaccines have done a great service to reopen portions of the economy by limiting the amount of new COVID cases. And so that's given tremendous benefit to ethanol, of course, because of the RFS. So it's been very good news all around. I mean, you look at the price of corn and RIN prices having recovered substantially. I think the outlook is very positive this summer. I think we certainly could see some very strong demand, given the fact that many Americans have been under restriction for, you know, various portions of the last year, coupled with the fact that international travel is still very difficult. I think we could see very strong demand portions of the summer. And of course, with the RFS and now with E15 year round, that poses, you know, a lot of good news for ethanol plants that had, you know, even as recently as a year ago, worried about the future.
John Zanker?
Do you have any comments on biodiesel and what's going on with the vegetable oils in general and the amount of fuel that we could be using here in the future?
Well, you know, just what I've read, it's not necessarily my forte, but watching the price of soybean oil soar and the potential opportunity for renewable diesel, you know, you're seeing a lot of companies like Valero make significant investments, seeing that this is the next huge opportunity. And with soybean prices, soybean oil prices continuing to rally, there's a lot of strength in that market and a lot of certain bright spots that we see coming.
I have a follow-up question on consumption. What are your expectations for year-over-year change in total miles driven in the U.S.? That would have to do with the number of gasoline gallons consumed and ethanol. And as a follow-up to something you mentioned about E15, does GasBuddy track E15 at the pump, and is it being very, very widely used, or is it simply a niche market?
We do track it. We started tracking it, I believe, 2 years ago. It's seen more uptake. I think the reason and potential is much stronger for E15 this summer, given that RINs further incentivizing retailers to blend more. And that offers a cost advantage to consumers who are seeing gas prices rise to their highest level in 7 years now at $3 a gallon. So you look at E15 prices that may in some cases now be traditionally 5 cents under regular, that may be 10 or even more cents under regular. And suddenly consumers have a higher level of interest when they see that there's a product available next to regular unleaded that looks familiar and can be used in their car and offer them a price advantage. So absolutely, I think that there will be more uptick in E15 demand this summer. And back to your first part of your question, I think this summer there's certainly the potential. And year over year, I mean, comparing to COVID, you know, we are going to see a tremendous recovery this summer. I was going to make a comparison to a normal summer. And I think certainly we could be a few single percentage points below where we were in 2019. Of course, there's a lot of potential wild cards that could surface. You know, I'd like to count on COVID being down and out. But if there are some sort of increases in cases that would restrict movements, If we do see inflationary pressures kind of start to run out of control, that could slow demand's recovery. But other than that, I think there's certainly the potential this summer that if not more than several weeks, maybe even, a quarter of the summer, depending on how hot the economy gets, we could be at close to or even over 2019's consumption. We could be seeing 10 million barrels a day of consumption for some of the busier holidays. And again, that tracks back to the fact that Americans are itching to get out. And they're essentially landlocked to the U.S. this summer. So I think consumption will be very, very healthy this summer.
And finally, Patrick, from you, as we let you go for the day, can you remind us, as your final word, what it is that Gas Buddy does?
Gas Buddy is a fuel and price tracker. And of course, we have the free app that's available for everyone's smartphone.
Hey, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Now let's turn our attention directly to the marketplace. Jackie Vakes of Total Farm Marketing, can you recap the USDA May WASD, World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates? They included, of course, for the very first time, a look at new crop corn and soybean numbers.
They did. And, there were quite a few interesting changes that went on. We finally got the extra 100 million exports for 2021 that we've been waiting for, and therefore we saw the carryout drop from 1.35 billion to 1.25 billion. Now, when you moved over to 21-22, because of the fact that they used 91.1 million acres, which came out of the Ag Forum, and 179.5, the crop size jumped to 14.99 billion, and we saw them actually increase ethanol. They left feed stay the same, but they decreased the exports. They dropped the exports down to 2.45 after having raised them to 2.775, which, you really got to look. That's the 325 million bushel switch from one year to the next. And basically, their explanation is that they expect that the UK and Russia are going to export a lot more corn. And so for right now, they felt that that was the safest way to go. When you looked at beans, man, that's a wild and crazy place. I can tell you that much. There, too, they stayed with the 87.6 that the Ag Forum had. They used 50.8 trend line yield, and that produced about a 300 million bushel bigger crop. But the interesting part about it is they actually dropped exports by 205 million bushels, and we ended up with 140 million bushel carryout. In other words, had they left exports the way they were, we'd have had a negative 65 million bushels. So it was quite interesting to watch. The other big thing, too, is on corn, average cash price went from 435 for this year to 570 for next year. For beans, 11.25 this year to 1385, and that's mailbox price. On wheat, we saw it go from 505 to 650. And, your world numbers basically, Todd, adjusted right along with everything that changed here in the U.S. We did see some changes down in Brazil. They dropped the corn crop, rightly so, by about 7 million metric tons, and it might get smaller than that yet. They didn't do many other changes there at all, but it's quite something. I tell you, it was quite the report.
It was an interesting report, Dave Chatterton. I did see that 570 cash price. That's the season's average price from USDA, as it's related to new crop corn, and wondered how the devil they got there. So I called and checked to make sure it wasn't a typo, and it was not, of course. And essentially, it's just at this time of year, looking forward kind of to the December corn price. And as it happens, Chicago thought they must be pretty close to right because they dropped the market pretty hard, Dave, down to that area, in fact. So what did we make of trade in Chicago? And remember, we're talking on Thursday afternoon, so there were some limit moves, at least during the day trade in Chicago for corn, and it was kind of ugly.
So, yeah, Todd, not the best reaction here. And obviously, momentum is a big part of the market and what's going on here. And, a good reminder today in today's action that we do have you know, expanded limits now on our daily moves and or our daily price limits for the Chicago futures. So 40 cents in corn, a dollar in beans, and 45 cents in wheat. We tested that out. That went into effect here just the first of the month, and we tested it out rather quickly after the report here today. And I think the story of the report is probably exports time. And when you look, I mean, Jackie certainly made the case, but when you look across the spectrum, corn, wheat, corn, beans, and wheat, you're talking about the USDA painting a picture that, that says we're going to lose almost 600 million bushels of exports year over year going into the 21-22 crop year. And, you know, at the same time, they're cutting back on the South American corn crop to the tune of 7 million metric tons. This time around, that's 275 million bushels. I think there's probably at least another 7 million to come out of that. You're doing this in a time where China has been a very aggressive buyer of global commodities, but in particular, U.S. corn and soybeans and other ag products. Yeah, they've also got a, you know, a very large $43 billion plus obligation here that to meet by the end of the year. And we're in a situation where the global economy is growing at the fastest rate that we've seen in decades. So I'm not sure that I follow that math. I think with all these reports, when we're talking about the May report and being an important, it's a starting point. It's a jumping off point. It's using February numbers on the yield and the acreage, and it's building out from there. So I think very similar to what we saw last year, the volatility that we've seen here in prices since the report is probably the tip of the iceberg. I think there will be a lot of changes to these numbers across the balance of the summer, and whether we'll have a big play and where we're at. We have a balance sheet, even with the changes made by the USDA yesterday, that is still essentially a pipeline supply or minimum pipeline supply in soybeans, and not very cushy in the corn market, leaving very little room for error. And in a situation where we'll have a very, I think, aggressive response to any perceived weather threat this summer. So the story is far from written. I think this is a starting point. We're always a little curious about how the USDA gets where they get. This will always be kind of a long and winding road here in just a little bit, but certainly I don't take it as a blow to prices. I don't think the USDA is actually too far off. I guess time will tell as far as their price projections go here.
Just one quick point of clarification. I've heard this a couple of times. On May 1, and CME Group changes the limits, trading limits, May 1st and November 1st. So every 6 months on a regular schedule. So on May 1, they change those limits. Based on volatility, the corn limit now is 40 cents, and then the expanded limit would be 60 if we were to have more than a couple of limit up contracts in any given trading day for soybeans. The trading limit is a regular daily limit is now a dollar. That leaves a lot of room for volatility, John Zanker, and I'm wondering how much of a whipsaw you expect over the next month and a half or 2 months as we try to put the end of the crop in the ground and begin what usually becomes a potential for a weather market in the United States.
Well, I think that we saw a hint, a strong hint today of what's going to happen. We've got that 40 cent limit in corn. We hit it. It was nice to see us bounce off it. And I think that, you know, geez, if it doesn't rain for the next 10 days to 2 weeks in Brazil, especially Mato Grosso, we could revisit the highs sooner than we think. Dave mentioned that they might be 7 million tons high on the Brazilian crop, and I think that's at least the number that we're looking at right now. You know, we've heard that people on the ground there are saying it's maybe closer to 90 and heading towards 85. Mato Grosso raises about 33% of that crop, and they've gone hot and they've gone dry, and the rest of the country saw some of the driest conditions in the last 40 years. So a few years back, we saw that crop drop to 80 million tons, and I think their growing season was going a little better back then than it is this year. So I think that's very key. And then that takes us back to that export number being dropped. I think that there's some ideas that China will not purchase the amount of corn that they did this year. I wouldn't bet a lot on that. Over the years, if we overanalyzed and talked about, and we just did it with soybeans, we've been overanalyzing what China was going to do with soybeans for the past year, and here they bought a record amount, and they're buying a record amount from Brazil. So I wouldn't rule out that export number climbing back to 300-400 million or 3 to 4 million, 300 to 400 million higher. So that takes that carryout down in the 1.2, 1.1 range with a 179.5 yield. And that's about 2.9 above the previous record. And will acreage gain? Well, you know, when we plant quickly, we tend to see a little bit of an acreage gain. I wouldn't be shocked to see a couple million, 1 to 2 million added there. So we have to have a good summer. And with all the things that we've seen in the last 3, 4, 5 years, and especially last year, I'm not sold quite yet that we're going to have that perfect growing season.
Jack Uvakes, we've been talking a great deal about Brazil. CONAB released their numbers at 7 a.m. on Wednesday morning before USDA released them at 11 a.m., both of those central time. Neither put the size of the corn crop in Brazil as low as I think probably the trade was expecting. And the second part of that comes from the export figures out of CONAB. They didn't lower those as well. And that nation has taken some policy steps to make sure that they can import corn in order to continue to export corn. Do you think their exports can fulfill the $1.4 billion thereabouts that they really want to put on the world marketplace?
Well, I think they don't have a choice but to at least make it appear that they can. You know, it's a circumstance where they, you know, it was mentioned how dry it is down there. A great deal of their grain moves via river, and they're having a lot of transportation problems. Just logistics is a huge issue. And so I think that they're going to try their very best to make it look like they can meet it, but I'm not certain that they're going to be able to. And, you know, Argentina, to be able to import corn, they're talking about importing corn from Argentina. But Argentina's government is not exactly in favor of that, let's put it that way. And, you know, I would expect to see their export tax increase. In other words, they'll penalize the farmer if he starts selling too much grain over to Brazil. So I think that it's going to be extremely interesting. Now, I looked at, you know, we talk about exports. I looked at shipments for corn. Right now, we have to ship 52 million bushels a week to the end of August to get to the 2.775 that they just raised us to. The last 11 weeks, we've been averaging 75.3. So, you know, we can see some lower exports inspections and still make that number that they had. But, you know, it's the export sales situation is an interesting one, you know, because the trade and the farmer a lot of times tend to look at export sales and think that 2.775 is an export sale. No, that's actually shipped. But the export sales is starting to see the switches from unknown, which we know is in the majority of cases is China. And what they're doing is they're turning around what they've done in the past. They're selling it to people who are our clients. South Korea, as an example, just switched unknown over to South Korea. And so how that's going to impact the trade and how the trade thinks about it is going to be something that'll be there. But I think, you know, when John said that basically, you know, we've overanalyzed and everything else, when we saw this week that CoFeed, which is an information service that provides information on how much China actually needs, disappeared at the end of April, and nobody's been heard from, that says to me that the situation over there is probably a lot more dire than what we might think it is, and they certainly don't want us to know that. So when I saw today happen, Todd, to be honest with you, I wasn't totally shocked. I certainly wasn't happy, but not totally shocked, because between black box selling, the fact that China came out and said, we're going to do everything we can to lower prices, which tells me that they were in here selling probably too, you know, and after this huge rise that we've just had, this isn't a shock. I went back and looked at, you know, we talked on Wednesday about 849 being the all-time high for corn. Do you know that we hit that all-time high on August 10th, and in the next three sessions, we dropped to 786. And when we hit 1789 in the next four sessions, we dropped to 1698. So these types, and back then we didn't have the limits that we have now. We had 12-cent limits on corn, you know. So this is a circumstance where I guess it's kind of like I look at this market and relate it to the stock market. if you lost 400 points on a stock market when it was at 8,000, it was a pretty big deal. And if you lose 400 points when it's at 34,000, it's not nearly as big a deal. It's kind of the way the corn and the bean market are right now.
Hey, Dave Chatterton, we do, from the corn market, need to keep the exports running. However, the bridge across the Mississippi River is going to create a problem, whether it's temporary, long-term, or short-term, I think is debatable. What do we know, and how much of an issue might it be for the rest of this marketing year, for corn in particular?
Well, it has pretty large implications, Todd, and the fact is we don't know. There's actually a meeting going on this afternoon. It was going to start at 3 o'clock, just as we're going to tape here, between the various administrations, but you've got a lot of people involved, a lot of fingers in this pie of what's going on. We knew that, you know, at least as of where we were at yesterday, we had 799 barges in the queue here this morning versus 411 last night. So this is a stack up that can happen very quickly. You know, the fact that there's, you know, no automobile traffic, that there's no river traffic allowed that might vibrate and shake, you know, shake the structure, tells us that we think it's pretty serious. Now, our sources seem to indicate, and the barge freight trading community seems to indicate, that they think it'll be reopened here within the coming days here, that it will not be a long-term problem. But certainly if it does, I mean, we've already seen quite a bit of pressure. To be fair, the pressure in the basis market was starting a little bit before we got the news of this closure, but it has helped to accelerate that. And we've seen the river terminal bids down somewhere in the order of 20 to 30 cents here in the last 10 days. And now we're starting to see the interior bids back off as well, and that's with a lower board price. And so it's a logistical issue, as Jackie said. We've got a record amount of corn sales on the books, and we've done the same thing in beans. The difference is those beans have primarily been shipped while we've still got a large amount of corn and a very active export program that needs to be attended to this summer. If for some reason the river stays closed for an inordinate amount of time, we have very few solutions for that. A rail and / truck, you know, substitution for that is not a very efficient model for the grain market.
John Zenker, we've spent a lot of time on this program and over the last several weeks talking about corn. Soybeans had been the lead market for some time. However, it's pretty clear that soybeans in domestically and on the global stage remain really tight in the supply side. What's your assessment of the market today?
I think that, and I have thought for several months, that when we get to July, we're going to be in a situation that we've never really been in. But we're going to find out just how close the USDA is with their 120. I think they've identified that number as being the pipeline. And at 2.6% stocks to usage, that matches the all-time high back from 13-14. And then I think the other folks here will remember at the start of harvest, in 14, we were out of beans, we were out of meal, and then we got a two-week wet forecast, and boom, we added a buck to futures with a record crop setting in the field. So I think that situation is going to occur earlier this year, and as early as July, and I think there's going to be some real scrambling. I think in the end, we could see that carryout fall under 100. If you remember last year, the Chinese came back into the market, started shipping a lot of beans in August as the Brazilians ran shorts, whether they will see that develop again or not. But averaged over, I think, 32 million bushels a week in August. Well, we can't do that this year. The beans just aren't going to be there. So if China gets a little bit hungrier than we expect right now, we're going to be really scrambling for soybeans. And what happens with the crop in the field at that point will certainly determine where prices can go. But the situation is extremely explosive, and the all-time highs are threatened, easily threatened, if we start talking about a yield falling under 50 million bushels, certainly 49.
I think I'll go around the horn with everybody, but we'll start, John, with you on what you believe producers should do at this point. About pricing new crop corn and soybeans, if anything, and where you are as well. Why don't you give me those data points, please?
Well, we're certainly at levels that are profitable, and we always have to take a look at that. If you've gotten your crop in, the crop's up, it's looking good. Certainly, it's easier to pull the trigger $14 beans, $6 corn, those are levels that are going to make a producer quite a bit of money, certainly with good yields. And if you're well insured, you can be pretty aggressive with those sales. I'm pretty bullish. I think we'll see. I think we'll see a rebound in here on any kind of scare, and certainly we're going to take off if we have any kind of extended hot and dry stretch in either side of the Corn Belt. We don't need a major drought. We don't need a 2012 or an 88 or an 83 type drought. 95. We just need something that dings the yield 5 to 10%, and off we go. So. Make some sales at those profitable levels. But I'd be looking at a minimum price scenario, you know, getting some attachments on there with your buyers that will keep in this ballgame, because, you know, sitting here today, we're still $4 off the high in beans on the November. And, you know, corn, there's a couple bucks there at least. And that's just assuming we only have a yield reduction of 5%. If you take that yield reduction to 10% in corn and soybeans, the all-time highs are going to fall, and probably fall pretty early.
Well, what I've been talking with people about is more related to their input costs, and saying, you know, we're making money this year. There's no two ways about it, because we had lower input costs. That's probably not going to be reality for next year. And if you're watching the fertilizer numbers, the prices have been going up steadily. So I've been trying to encourage them to get out there and take care of some of their inputs for next year. As far as this year goes, we've done some put strategies, so that we continue to have opportunity for the upside, and just basically trying to stay in touch and continue to talk. The problem that a lot of guys have is, you know, they rewarded this market on the way up, but didn't re-own, you know, like they probably should have. And so now they're afraid to do anything almost in some respects. But these are numbers that it's okay to be afraid at. We're still making good money. But my biggest concern is for next year and what's going to happen there, because we know what happened the last time we hit these kind of prices and input costs went right through the roof.
So some really good points, you know, already have been made. And, you know, for our personal standpoint, or from my personal standpoint, pretty happy with where we're at right now and what the market has offered us at this point. You know, we're roughly in a 25 to 35% priced or marketed for new crop wheat owned calls and call spreads against a good portion of that. And to Jackie's point, and to John's, you know, maintain some upside here. These are very profitable levels. You're talking about, you know, $1,200 an acre gross revenue in corn, maybe $800 to $900 in beans. And definitely your banker and yourself should be paying attention to that. But this is the situation where we do have that explosive element, because stocks are so tight, and not only in the U.S., but also globally in terms of exportable stocks, that if we encounter a weather problem this summer, things are certainly going to get, you know, going to get aggressive here. And putting $1 on corn or $2 on beans is not going to be a too tough of a task. So if you're a little bit more risk adverse, get some more sales on the books. Cash sales are great. I mean, I would prefer an HTA that doesn't lock in basis, but making a sale eliminates the downside. But you want to make sure that you're able to participate in that upside. In doing so, I don't think we need to be in a big rush to get 60 or 80% sold. We have taken a dabble on the 2022 crop. Just as Jackie mentioned, inputs out there. I mean, I'd love to be locking some stuff in, but it's almost impossible at this point to get much in the way of pricing. So it's a big unknown, and it remains that way. You know, I think if you look at your crop insurance numbers, prices right now for December corn about $1 above where that spring average was, or spring price was on corn. It's a little bit more than $2 on soybeans. So keep that in mind if you've got the harvest price option, or if you've got a price flex or a crop insurance product that will allow you to up your average across the summer. You're getting in better and better shape in doing that. The other thing that I would mention is that we have a number of producers who are operating on flex leases. And be aware of how those work in your marketing plan. If the market continues to go higher, your effective cash rent is going up and up and up, and you have a lot more downside risk maybe than somebody who is not in that situation. So factor that into what you're doing, and just be prepared to reward the market here. Have a plan, stay disciplined, be aware of time, and kind of know where you're at in the cycle here. We've got a June crop report at the end of the month, which will update our acreage number. That has the chance to add, probably as has been mentioned, million or 2 acres onto each corn and soybeans. I think there'll be mitigating factors, and I would fully expect if we find those acres that the USDA will raise their usage numbers here, kind of what we highlighted earlier. But, you know, we have to be aware of that and going forward.
Commodity Week, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of our program anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. Our thanks go to our panelists today, including Dave Chatterton of Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, Illinois, Jackie Vex of Total Farm Marketing out of Hollister, Missouri, John Zanker from Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana, and our special guest, Patrick DeHaan of Gas Buddy in Chicago. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.